Hi, Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist. Welcome to Season 3, Episode 13. Continuing with the Colonial Craftsman series, this will be the weaver we'll talk about today. So the first weavers who worked professionally in this country were a group of 20 Yorkshire families that John Pearson had set up as a cloth factory in Raleigh, Massachusetts in 1638. It was to process their work that he started this filling mill. They spun and wove wool from Spain. England would export no raw wood, and the few sheep then in the colony yielded far less than enough for household use in the colonies. The Yorkshiremen also wove cotton brought all the way from India. There is ample proof that some woven working at home became highly skilled weavers and had equipment for producing quite intricate patterns. The simplicity of their looms held most home weavers down to a plain over and under weaving called tabby. Done in wool, this made warm, sturdy cloth of the homespun kind, likely to be a little stiff for clothing. By using pre-dyed yarn, the simplest looms could yield and weave linen in stripes, checks, and even plaids, and that plaids was a gingham. A colonial home loom differed not at all from European looms of the 14th century, and apparently very little from the Roman ones. A local carpenter made its frame, big as a four-poster bed, exactly as he would frame a house or even a barn, with mortise and tenon joints. Only he often drove a wedge in to hold the tenon instead of pinning it with a tree nail. And this made it, very mobile loom. And you can find actually one of these in Williamsburg. And this, in doing so, driving the wedges made the frame very stiff and also allowed it to be, readily moved and taken apart. But also what it did was when the wood dried out during the seasons, as far as the fireplace, they could just tap the wedges in a little more and tighten it right back up. So the builder had to make every part of the loom absolutely square. A crooked loom weaves a crooked web. So any loom must hold the parallel warp threads stretched from front to back at a convenient working height, and also allow them to be moved forward as the web grows, and also provide the weaver with a means of raising part of the warp threads to form a shred, with the rest through which to pass the shuttle carrying the weft yarn, and provide a device for compacting each new weft yarn against the already woven piece in question. So considering these points, what the loom would do, what it would make, produce, in order and in the forms they took on the old barn looms. Number one, the warp was fed from the warp beam, actually a roller across the back of the loom, and led forward to a smoother timber, the breast beam, above which the weaver leaned when he did his work. The parallel threads crossed over the rounded edge of the breast beam, then down and back to attach to the cloth beam, which was another roller, just out of the way of the weaver's feet. So number two, as work progressed, the weaver used a crank at the side to turn the cloth beam from time to time and roll up the finished fabric. Both cloth beam and warp beam had ratchets, sometimes only wrapped in ropes with weights, which the weaver could release or set to hold the warp at the proper tension. The weaver always slacked the tension when work was interrupted to avoid a break across the cloth. Number three, the weaver worked on a rather high, backless bench hung across the front of the loom. About halfway between the bench and the warp beam, the warp threads passed through the harness. A simple household loom had but two of these hangings parallel from the ends of the two ropes which passed over the roller lying across the top of the loom. In their old form, though, each harness was no more than two sticks, one above the warp and one below it, connected by the headies, which were stretched vertically between them. The headies were string, and they were metal or plastic now, and each had an eye tied to it in its middle through which the warp thread passed. The warps, carried by the headies, of the front harness lay between the headies and the rear harness, and vice versa. A short rope hitched to the middle of the lower stick of each harness was tied to the middle of the two treadles extending from the back of the loom to a point within reach of the weaver's feet. Trampling on the treadle pulled its harness downward, somewhat tightening it, and then the ropes over the roller pulled the other upward at the same time, each carrying its own warp threads with it. For tabby weaving, these were every other thread, so a shed was opened with, say, the odd threads up and the even threads down, just as an example. The weaver threw the shuttle, trailing a weft behind it, through the shed, tamped on either side of the treadle to bring the odds down and the evens up, and thus enclosed the new weft. This tramping created a new and different shed through which he threw the shuttle up back. The smooth, boat-shaped shuttle was whittled out of a close-grained wood-like box, dogwood, or even holly, very hard, very tight grain. A narrow cavity in the shuttle held the weft, wound on a quill, usually a section of hollow reed that rotates freely on a wire spring, between the ends of the recess. The yarn ran out through the hole in the shuttle's side. Number 4. After each shuttle pass, the weaver pulled the heavy batten toward him to compact his web. It bumped when it hit, and one might guess that the characteristic sound of the colonial village was a steady thumping from house after house. The batten's weight came from a crosswise timber, the shuttle race hanging below the warp on two long wooden bars pivoted at the top of the loom. A second, lighter member crossed above the warps and fixed between it, and the shuttle race was the slayer reed. This was a compact or comb-like affair through which all the warp threads passed. It was the reeds of the slay that bumped the cloth when the weaver swung the batten. These are now metal, but originally they were actually slivers of reed. The loom, used by colonial experts, differed from the simple one in having at least four harnesses and sometimes as many as 12. By shedding selected warp threads instead of merely alternate ones, and thus letting some weft threads pass over several warps at once, this loom could weave patterns. These could be small surface variations in one color or quite large repeats in a different color from that of the backgrounds. Such were the overshot coverlets in wide varieties, which were prized examples of old-type weaving. They were woven on cotton warp and two wooden wefts, each of a different weight and of different colors. The lighter yarn matched the warp, and the tie-down of the harness allowed two to weave as a tabby background at the same time that the heavier yarn wove the overshot pattern of contrasting color. Professional weavers made the bulk of these coverlets in the early 19th century. A harness had to come straight down, so the cord from the treadle had to be tied to the middle of the lower harness stick. Since four or more treadles couldn't at all be in the middle, multiple harnesses, looms, used lambs to equalize the pull. Lambs were slats hanged to the side of the loom, one lying under each harness. It was easy to tie the middle of a harness down to its lamb, and the proper treadle could be hitched to one lamb wherever the two had crossed. The weaver's most exciting job was warping. Schemes of warp yarn went on a swift to be wound from it onto long spools as women would have done in these small cottages, particularly found in Ireland and Wales and Scotland. Rows of the spools stood on vertical wires in a frame on the wall. The weaver drew threads from them in bouts of 40, which she measured to the full length of the projected web around pegs in a long warping board, or driven into the wall of her workroom. She tied each bout together at both ends and looped it onto a loose chain for hauling. With the threads spread evenly, she fastened an end of each bout to the warping beam, and undid the chains as she rolled the whole business onto the beam at even tension. The exact methods for doing this are beyond the scope of our talk here, but a quite coarse linen will make 30 warp threads to the inch, or 900 to a 30-inch wide web. These had to be drawn in through the correct heddles according to the draw of the pattern. If at the end the weaver found one warp end threaded wrong, he had to take it every strand beyond it out of the heddles and put them in correctly. And from the harnesses, the weaver slayed each warp through the reed and secured its end with a cloth beam. The whole operation took him, the end, three helpers, 2 days or more. Except to an expert weaver, a draft, as we know now and spell it, gives no more idea of a pattern than does written music to the tone deaf. Drafts resemble music in a way. There's an old joke about the weaver setting up a loom from a couple of bars of Mendelssohn's Spring Song. Actually, a draft diagrams not the pattern but the loom itself. The old one, slicked up here for clarity, used each horizontal line to represent one harness and each tick on a line to mark a warp threaded into the harness. This whole pattern, used for a kind of tweed, covers less than an inch and repeats continuously. The zeros at the left under the harness lines show to which treadles each is tied, and the numbers on the vertical spaces give the order in which the treadles are to be tamped. Competent weavers read drafts as easily as English can weave them, with a pen on squared paper to judge their appearance. Further, they can write from a sample, or even from a photograph. Modern draft writers use the spaces between horizontal lines for the harnesses and fill them in solid to mark warps. As you may see or hear from Sweetbriar Beauty. Sweetbriar Beauty is one of those simpler coverlet patterns. It's a standard. Their variations are extensive and their names fanciful. A lot of these were put together by Irish women, or the names were put forth by Irish women, such as the Blazing Star, the Wig Rose, the Star of Bethlehem, Queen's Fancy. For example, some patterns have different names in different states. A few are very old and even come from Europe, but the American weavers invented dozens that Europe never even saw. The weavers made the cloth from their own materials to sell in the open market. Customers bespoke much of their work, and the weaver wove with yarn that the customer spun. This was especially true of coverlets. The Pennsylvania Museum owns a pattern book of bed cover designs by weaver John Lance. These are not drafts, but were obviously drawn to show his customers. For spinning wheels, had to work full-time to keep one weaver in yarn. But since most spinners could work only between household chores, the real figure came near to 8 or 10 wheels per loom. A weaver often quit work to ride his nag through the country hunting yarn. In 1767, when English weaver James Hargraves' little daughter, Jenny, upset the spinning wheel, He noticed that it ran for a moment, and then its spindle standing vertical. This gave him an idea for a machine that eventually spun cotton on 80 spindles at once. The Jenny solved the English weft shortage, but it couldn't manage the steady tension needed for drawing out the hard-twisted warp. Thomas High thought of stretching the yarn between two pairs of rollers, one pair turning faster than the other. Richard Arkwright unethically seized the idea for his water frame, the first machine to use water power for spinning, weft, and warp. The yarn supply problem vanished in England, and the weavers prospered. But the hand spinners did not, unfortunately. Botched copies of Jennies tried out in America didn't work well. The British government prevented the removal from the island of any cotton spinning machinery or any model of drawing of one. A young Englishman, Samuel Slater, broke through the fence with a remarkable way. He apprenticed himself to one of Arkwright's and many cotton spinning partners and deliberately memorized every detail of the methods in the machines. Then he sailed secretly for America in 1789. He signed a contract with a wealthy Quaker merchant, Moses Brown, who controlled a cotton mill full of nearly useless jennies in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Slater scraped the lot. He chalked outlines of machines, parts on timber, and then he had Sabibus Brown cut them out for him. He made sketches of iron parts, and Ozial Wilkinson and his sons forged them, while Slater successfully courted Ozial's daughter, Hannah. When the work was done, water power ran machines for carding, which was combing and condensing into a thick strand, and drawing, which is stretching with rollers, roving, which is even more stretching and slight twisting, and finally spinning on an Arkwright frame. Soon Slater was spinning cotton warp so good that his new wife and her sisters respun some of their home wheels into America's first cotton sewing thread. The mill made more than one hand weavers, made more than the hand weavers could use, and in 2 years had a ton of yarn on hand, literally 2,000 pounds. Slater got a note from Moses Brown saying, "These must be shut down, you mean the water gates, or they will spin all my farms into cotton yarn, and we need to keep doing vegetables." Slater's cotton came from the West Indies. The southern states were growing some, but slow hand removal of seeds held down production. But then, in 1793, young Eli Whitney went to South Carolina as a tutor. And in less than 2 weeks, he built a crank-run machine that removed more cotton seeds in an hour than a hand could pick out in 3 days. This, of course, was the cotton gin, which the whole South copied freely without permission. The price of slaves jumped, and everybody planted cotton. More spinning mills sprung up, even up in New England, but they all spun still, and they had to be woven by hand. Over in England, the Reverend Edmund Cartwright learned that the spinning mills there were turning out more yarn than the weavers could in England. So, without ever having seen a weaver work, he built a power loom. Assuming that weaving was hard work, he made his first springs so powerful that a strong man could hardly turn the machine's crank. But when he did turn it, the loom broke. Cartwright was granted a patent in 1785. Francis Cabot Lowell visited England in 1811 and succeeded in seeing the kinds of cotton machinery except the power loom. Nevertheless, with the brilliant help of Paul Moody, he built a completely able power loom from scratch. The revolving eccentric cone that drove his machine was later adopted for all looms around the world. By the late 1830s, water power was weaving plain woolen cloth in this country. Two looms, watched by a single operator, produced 20 to 30 yards per day. But home-operated spinning wheels still spun much of the wool yarn for them. So this was about to end. Even then, machines in England were successfully spinning prime wool yarn. The first imported Jacquard loom started its complex work in Philadelphia in 1826. It deserves some sort of credit as the first automation. Its punch cards could control every individual warp thread, and so could weave any kind of pattern, including bed covers with realistic flowers on them, and with borders of eagles and uplifting mottos. Though these charm people, just as the butcher furniture did, the Jacquard didn't quickly oust the hand weavers. One of them, Weaver Rose, unkempt and snuff-spindled, but a master who had learned the trade by long apprenticeship, still worked in the early years of the 20th century. Back in 1898, Alice Morris Earle predicted that the craft would die with them. She was wrong, though. Partly, though, him weaving continued as a handicraft, and it is said that there are more hand looms in this country now than ever before, even in the colonial times. Perhaps there are, but few of them work as hard as those did. And I can further go on to verify this. Even locally here in South Jersey, I probably know of about 25 looms that are, operating on a semi-regular basis. And a lot of those weavers are doing a lot of teaching. So they're expanding the base of the art and the craft of weaving. So what a great thing. I wish we could do that in horology and ebonystery and the like of the trades, the colonial trades, not these ridiculous things that they put into Votech today. I mean, anybody can be an electrician or a plumber or anything like that, but these are combinations of high craft and high art, and we sorely miss having them. So, and as you go through generations and decades and generations of people that don't see things like this, they have no idea that it existed. Not that it actually existed, but the feel and touch of something, I hate to use this as an example, but the manual shifter on automobiles is almost extinct. Only about 1.75% in America of all cars sold, it doesn't matter what the car is a manual shifting transmission. So all those people in the last 30 to 40 years have no idea how to shift one. They're probably very afraid if they ever saw one and had to get in a car like that. And I remember when I was in England, studying in England, architectural preservation and horology at the British Horological Institute, that, when I rented a car, because it was on the steering was on the opposite side, I mean, I was actually shifting with my left hand. And try going around a circle in reverse, a roundabout circle, as they call it, and shifting with your left. You're thinking about each gear. You're not being aware of the automobile around you. But so it just goes to show you that as these things get glossed over generation after generation, there's such massive loss of knowledge and understanding how we got to where we are here today. And so very, very, very sad. And we look at fabric and we just take for granted that we go to the store. I mean, most people do, not me, but most people, and they go to their department stores or their specialty shops, and it's like, do they ever question where the fabric came from? They just want to see how cute the top or the pair of slacks looks on them. They're not even contemplating that. When I'm looking at what interests me and makes me move, really moves me with passion, is to seeing, some things from Ireland and from Scotland, and, these wonderful wool-woven sport coats and caps that men used to wear, the vest and the pants, the knickers, and just absolute masterpieces that go back a couple hundred years now, that these companies and these individuals that are still doing it, in Scotland, they have, a couple hundred individuals in their own homes making, say, sport coats. One makes this one, the other makes the other one. And they send it into a company, and the company calls themselves, George's Sports Wool Coats, just being facetious. But, that's how it's done. It's done on a cottage industry type basis. but there's such low demand for these things. They're cheap. I mean, how cheap? I mean, you can buy a wonderful handmade sport coat from Scotland for, what, $200, $250? That's criminal. And then we go to our stores and we look at this garbage from China and other Asian countries just being turned out by the millions by automated this and automated that. So very, very frustrating. But we could go on and on. Not going to go on and on. We're trying to, at the Historic Preservationist here, trying to expand everyone's horizons in this series anyway and understand how many specific individual colonial craftsmen there were. And again, these individuals that they think they're the plumber, the electrician, the carpenter today, they have no idea. They have no idea what real craftsmanship is, and nor do they want to. It's all greed-driven. Very few that I know are passionate about what they do. So very sad. But look, if you like what we're doing here, trying to help educate and get the word out of what things that interest me, the historic preservationist Greg Perry, please check us out on Instagram. We have a whole series of videos. We have hundreds and hundreds on Instagram, the Historic Preservationist, and that leads you to IGTV for 15-minute videos. And also we have our YouTube channel, The Historic Preservationist. And please hit the like button. It helps us get along and helps us get more noticed. And it's all about educating people here. We don't make a dime. We don't make a penny. You look on these YouTube channels and everybody is sponsoring somebody, sponsoring a tool, sponsoring of this. They're there to monetize it, to make money, not me. I'm here to help educate people. These are lost trades and we're losing our culture in this country. Greg Perry, the Historic Preservationist, signing off. Thanks, everyone, for listening.